like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Must be an animal. Come hear the animals. Talking animals. Talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest today is Cameron Moore, program manager, Million Cat Challenge, collaborative undertaking of Maddie's Fund, the Maddie's Shelter Medicine Program at the University of Florida, the UC Davis Corrett Shelter Medicine Program, and the ASPCA. As part of her responsibilities, Moore had a longstanding commitment to do a shelter consult today at this exact time, so we were unable to conduct a live interview with her, but did record one on Monday. In that conversation, which I'll play back in just a few moments, we discussed the Million Cat Challenge, a shelter-oriented campaign designed to save the lives of 1 million cats in North America within a 5-year term. A highly ambitious goal, and the last thing I wanted to do is create my own spoiler, so let's just say, so far, so good. Discuss initiatives that form the core of the Million Cat Challenge, what sorts of challenges shelters can face in embracing the tenets of the campaign, what the results have been thus far, what the implications of those results are, both for cats and for shelters, and more. Plus, Moore is giving two talks at KittyCon Tampa 2019, a cat-centric extravaganza happening November 30th and December 1st. I'll play back that conversation I recorded Monday with Cameron Moore in just a few moments here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Later in the program, I'll speak with Michelle LaFleur about the 13th annual Tampa Thanks Vegan, which takes place, fittingly enough, on Thanksgiving Day at the UU Church of Tampa. Michelle will fill us in on the details of what's become a very popular event, including the various approaches for bringing a dish or not bringing a dish, how that might affect your ticket price, making reservations, etc. Also, a programming note for next Wednesday on somewhat of a related note, which of course is the day before Thanksgiving. I won't be coming over here that day, so the fabulous Bev Capshaw will be hosting Talking Animals in my absence. On the other hand, on the Saturday and Sunday of Thanksgiving weekend, I will be back in this neck of the woods at KittyCon Tampa 2019, interviewing various experts, filmmakers, and others. So I had a few questions for people intrigued about this, to know more. So you can visit kittycontampabay.org for more information. Right now, though, let's play my conversation with Cameron Moore, recorded Monday. This is Cameron Moore on Talking Animals on WMNF.
Thank you so much for joining us on Talking Animals today, Cameron.
Thanks, Duncan. I'm glad to be here.
So we will, of course, get to the Million Cat Challenge and related topics in a moment or two, but first, I'd like to learn a bit about you. What you do for a living is pretty singular, so I'd like to trace that path a bit. And in fact, let's go back pretty far. How much were cats part of your life when you were a kid?
Well, I always had them. I was a military brat, and we moved around the country my whole life, and we always had a couple cats. And I consider myself a cat lover, but I also had dogs, too. I never thought this would be turn into a career for me.
Oh, okay. So you grew up, you were sort of bipartisan in that way.
There you go.
I found that many people whose jobs involve working on behalf of animal welfare often had a particular animal that was special to them. There was some sort of powerful connection. Might have been in childhood, might have been later on. Do you have one of those animals in your story somewhere?
Oh my gosh, it would be hard for me to single out one.
Yeah.
And I do have quite a few. So I feel like I'm just drawn to animals in general.
Yeah.
I love them all.
Right.
Sure.
But was there one that amongst those faves that maybe felt like something magical or maybe was partly responsible for spurring you to step into the kind of work that you do or just something that maybe had a more transformative impact on you?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'll never forget the day my mom brought home this little teeny tiny black kitten named Misha, who I didn't realize this, but she had adopted it from the local shelter and surprised us with it. And Misha ended up living with us into her senior years. And definitely, I think she probably had an impact on me without me even really thinking about that. So
okay.
She was my constant companion.
cool. And that was Misha?
Mm-hmm.
Nice. Okay, cool. What was your first job working with animals?
That actually didn't happen until 2008. I had volunteered throughout the years with animals, but I always felt I had to have a real job to pay the bills to support my habit of,
okay.
Volunteering. So
it's incumbent on me to ask, I guess, first, then what was your real job during those years before you jumped all the way in?
Well, again, growing up in the military, I then decided to marry into the military. So I continued moving. So I recreated myself everywhere I moved.
Oh, wow.
My last career, though, was in commercial real estate before I ended up switching over to animal welfare.
Wow. Okay, interesting. And so what was it, even though it sounds like in some ways later in life as a job, sounds like you've been working with animals and as a volunteer for many, many moons. When you actually started drawing a paycheck for the work that you obviously had loved and felt passionate about before, what do you remember having any kind of conversation with yourself saying, oh my goodness, I mean, it makes sense that I had to pay the bills and I was doing other stuff, including real estate, whatever, but this is exactly what I should be doing, and I want to keep doing it no matter what.
Oh, definitely. So, ironically, I was kind of, I lucked into this position moving into animal welfare, and it was because of corporate downsizing. And ironically, when my position was eliminated, my bosses told me, this is such a great opportunity for you. Now you can do what you're passionate about. And I thought, well, how's that going to pay the bills, right?
Yeah, and so, also nice spin, right?
Thank you for eliminating my job after 9 years, you know, was out of their control. But
right.
Even still, I never thought that it really would be the start of something really magical for me. And now I just can't believe that this is my job. So I'm very, very fortunate. But I never thought this could be a career because I'm not a veterinarian. I didn't have special training to be in animal welfare, and I only knew of certain jobs that you could have. So I thought, well, you know, there's nothing there for me, but turns out there is.
Where was the very first paid job, and what did it involve doing?
Right. So actually that's here in Jacksonville, Florida, where I live.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an organization called First Coast NOMA Homeless Pets that had started as just a small nonprofit without any kind of facility and turned into one of the largest spay neuter clinics in the country. And just as they were transitioning into a building and having staff going from a volunteer only basis, I was hired on to be their program director. So that was my first paying gig. And ironically, I was asked to head up a program here in Jacksonville, which was new at the time. And it was a return to field program. We dubbed it Feral Freedom because we didn't know what we were. We didn't know that all these cats that lived outside weren't ferals. So we just thought it was a cute, catchy name.
Mm-hmm.
Now that we know better, I wish we could go back and change it. But it is what it is.
Yeah. And also, I think encouraging to just that, even that the first part of the story right now, encouraging to people who had, like yourself, volunteered for many moons, because it sounds like when the professional job situation shifted, that you had so much great volunteer experience that you could step into a really nice opportunity.
Yeah, it definitely helps. And it's been a lot of on-the-job training.
Yeah. No, but I just mean that people out there who, like yourself, maybe just for years have volunteered and thought, well, could I step into that world in a way
definitely.
Where I can make a living at it? I mean, I think that's kind of an inspirational tale right there, that it's like, yeah, you can. I mean, it's not necessarily going to be easy, and everybody's path is different, of course, but I think that's super encouraging, that just doing something out of pure love and passion did lead you to a job that's now full of love and passion. So,
well, and ironically, I didn't actually pursue this job. I was approached by the founder of the organization while I was hosting a cat adoption event at PetSmart. So he recruited me out of PetSmart, which was really kind of funny because, again, I would never have known about this. I would have probably just tried to find another office job.
Wow. And who was that recruited you?
Rick Ducharme.
Okay, cool.
The founder of First Coast NOMA Homeless Pets. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, great. Yeah, I've spoken to him, of course, on the show, and that's a pivotal program, and he's therefore certainly a pivotal figure in all this kind of stuff that we'll be talking about shortly here. So let me just let folks know, this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest is Cameron Moore, program manager of the Million Cat Challenge, a shelter-oriented campaign that set out to save the lives of 1 million cats in North America, and we'll talk about how that went more specifically in a moment. She'll be speaking, by the way, at KittyCon Tampa 2019, which is happening November 30th and December 1st. This conversation was recorded Monday. So given all those years in the shelter world before this opportunity came along, before we get more steeped in cats, I'd be curious to have you sort of characterize the prevailing attitude in shelters about cats versus dogs. In what ways, if any, are they viewed differently?
Oh, definitely. And that's the whole basis of why the Million Cat Challenge was even created.
Yeah.
You know, while shelter staff, they love animals, it is very centered towards dogs.
Yeah.
And dogs always get the better housing, they get the better medical care, and cats are almost like an afterthought. So we go, as part of my job is consulting with shelters around the country, it's really funny, I've had to be very specific about the questions I even ask them, because when I ask, for example, you know, are the animals vaccinated when they first come in the shelter, the answer is always yes. But then when I ask specifically, are the cats vaccinated? Oh, no, we don't bother with them.
Yeah.
So I've had to learn, and and always, you know, cats are the afterthought, even in just how shelters are built.
Yeah.
Dogs end up having, nicer runs, or they might have outdoor access, or they have all kinds of great things. And then back in the corner, there's this little closet, and that's where we're going to shove all the cats.
That's the cat room. Yeah. Why are you, given all your years in and around people who, again, have huge love of animals, but have you had a theory, have you developed a theory as to why? It's a bias of sorts, right? And so what's behind that, near as you can tell?
It is, but I feel animal control agencies were originally designed as a rabies control, and then also they were created for public and animal safety, which mostly revolved around dogs, with dog bites or dangerous dogs. And over the years, it's evolved to intake cats. And even in some states where the enforcement agencies are not even required to deal with cats, they sometimes think of it as we're providing a service to our community,
mm-hmm.
but it's actually not a service to the cats, because the majority of the cats that are going into their shelters are simply being euthanized.
Yeah. So I guess as part of that just philosophical difference, it's almost natural that in many cases, programs or campaigns are often designed very differently for dogs versus cats.
Oh, yes, very much so.
So that may bring us, in fact, to the Million Cat Challenge. So what did it, for people who are listening that just may not be that familiar with, let's sort of start off at least slightly in the remedial level. So what is it, and what did it seek to do when it was launched?
Sure. So Million Cat Challenge is actually the brainchild of two really amazing veterinarians who also teach at the university level. So Dr. Julie Levy and Dr. Kate Hurley. Dr. Levy is with the University of Florida, the Maddie Shelter Medicine Program, and Dr. Hurley is with UC Davis, the Corret Shelter Medicine Program. And they both were working with shelters all around the country and seeing the huge disparity between dogs and cats, how dogs were saved at a much higher level than cats were. And so they thought, what are some ways that we can help empower shelters to even the playing field and to be able to help cats just like they do with dogs? And so they put it out there as an idea and invited shelters to participate. And it was basically like, join our club. We'll give you some tools. It's all free. And everything is based on, you know, you can choose what you want to do and what you don't want to do. There's no requirement. And we came up with five really great initiatives to try to help the cat. And initially there were 1,000 shelters signed up to do this. And again, on a voluntary basis, there was no real incentive to join other than people's own desire to stop euthanizing so many cats in the shelters where they work. And the goal was to save 1 million cats more than what were already being saved. So the Dr. Hurley and Dr. Levy started collecting data from these shelters to come up with a baseline number. And they said, our goal is to save 1 million more cats in 5 years. And then the amazing thing is that we achieved that million saving in 4 years instead of 5 years. So then we thought, well, let's save 2 million. And so then we've actually saved 2 million already. And so now it's, let's save all the cats. cat, you know, and finding the right outcome for every cat.
That's great to exceed that sort of ambitious of a goal in terms of the timetable. What do you think accounts for that? Was there just that there was more shelters that signed on than maybe the original projections had suggested? Or what accounts for doing so well, really, and again, beating that goal before that five-year mark was reached?
Well, honestly, I think it's the actual initiatives themselves. They work. Mm-hmm. And when you talk to someone who's not implementing these, they always tell you, well, we can't because we're different. Our community's different. It wouldn't work here because we're in the north or we're in the south or we're wherever. But we know these strategies work everywhere. And I think having this community, you know, all of these shelters, we have an ability to communicate with each other in a safe environment. So nobody's calling anybody names. And people could ask questions of their peers. Like, I would like to implement this initiative, but I'm worried. I'm worried that my community is going to yell at me. And then other shelters could say, we were worried too, but we did it, and this was our result. And it became so much easier for shelters to have confidence, and they weren't recreating the wheel. They were learning from their peers, and it works. And if you do it, you will start saving lives.
Well, that's great, because it sounds like among the things that were sort of crucial was that there was a template there that people could point to, especially if they were uneasy. What were some of the chief concerns or fears when you just gave that example about people saying, hey, we're not sure how the community will react to this, or if maybe they're not going to like that? What were some of the big reservations in that way that people had before they maybe embraced it more fully?
Well, as an open admission municipal shelter, which is the majority of the shelters we work with. We do also work with private nonprofit shelters who maybe have contracts with their local municipality, but everybody feels like they're the victim. Like, we have to take in these cats because we are the open admission shelter or because we have this contract. But in all honesty, you really don't always have to intake animals. We've, again, turned it into a convenience for the public. Remember, animal shelters were created for that public and animal safety. We weren't created to be everything for everyone. So, for example, when we have managed admissions is one of our strategies. And what it means is, how can I help you help your animal, but then not necessarily taking it into the shelter? Because again, you know, if 100 animals come in today and I'm already full, how am I really benefiting this animal? How is my staff going to be able to take care of them? Where am I going to have space? Am I going to have to euthanize in order to make space? We do have to manage our workload. Otherwise, we're not able to provide the best service to everyone. So people would see that, though, as, you're trying to turn people away. No, I'm trying to help them in a different way so that we can better help the animal. And so the fear is we couldn't do that because our commissioners or our public would yell at us and they would think we're not helping. But what they found is, like, if you went to the dentist, you wouldn't just show up for a cleaning. You make an appointment because you don't feel like sitting there and waiting all day. So a lot of shelters, the big complaint is, I've sat out here for 3 hours. I'm still waiting to turn in this animal. But if I could give you an appointment and if I could help you, then you came in, and when it's your appointment time, I could just get you in and out. Like, wouldn't you rather have that than sitting out in the hot sun or in the cold or in your car for hours?
And to take that example, metaphor maybe a little bit further, Cameron, so is part of the thing where people were concerned how the reaction would be to the shelters offering alternatives to bringing that cat into the shelter. So then the rap, I guess, would have been, well, they didn't want to take the cat or they didn't want to help us. But what you're talking about is, like, here are some alternatives. So back to the dentist appointment thing, were there, hey, there's a couple other alternatives we have to getting your teeth cleaned today. Here's two or three of them. Maybe you might want to consider this, which is equally good and it's available. And I mean, is that kind of what the thinking was, to take this a step further? Is let's not necessarily bring them in if two or three of these other alternatives are actually, in the case of this cat or that cat, perfectly viable.
There's studies out there now that are showing that a good portion of the people who are surrendering animals don't actually want to surrender to the shelter. They just need temporary help. Mm-hmm. But no one's asking them, what do you need and how can I help you?
Right.
So by setting up an appointment, for example, for owner surrenders, we would encourage you set it up for 2 weeks, for example, from now, not tomorrow, because we want to give you the opportunity of being able to find another solution. Because adding an animal into a shelter is not always always the best outcome for that pet. It's very stressful. You're exposing them to infectious disease. There can be overcrowding, which then leads to euthanasia, or illness, which then leads to euthanasia. So again, if we could offer some other opportunities for you, what a lot of times happens and what successful shelters are seeing all around the country is, with a little bit of help, people are figuring out either how they can keep their pet or how they can move it from their home directly into the next home, bypassing the shelter altogether. And that's what's best for the animal. So if it's just a matter of you've lost your job, you're in a panic, you're not even sure how you're going to pay your rent next month, let alone take care of your dog, can we provide you with some food or medical care if you need it, or even temporary foster, you know, something to help you until you get back on your feet? And then the great thing is, in 2 days, you've landed another job and your life is back on track, but you didn't know that 2 days ago. So 2 days ago, you were in a panic and you thought this was the end of the world. And now that things are back on track, you don't have to give up your pet. And that's an amazing thing.
No, that's great. So is the idea then that generally when someone is in that scenario, try to suggest, hey, come see us in 2 weeks. But again, is there also initially, is there a way to present that in such a way that people don't, who are already probably in some cases, like the examples you gave, exasperated, they lost a job, they can't feed the animal, the vet bills are piling up. So are they concerned? It's like, oh, I don't know about the 2 weeks. Or is that when you, the exact moment to intervene and say, well, how can we help you for now kind of get through those next several days or 2 weeks? And here,
right,
let's hear
right. And
story.
I think once you have that conversation with someone and you find out what's going on, you will have good solutions for
them. Yeah, especially if, like you say, I think most people, and I hope you're right, and I think you are right, that they might just be at the end of their rope and just trying to, like, crisis manage. And so they're thinking, okay, well, I have to surrender the cat. I that'll take the pressure off. But they, of course, are probably super torn. And so if somebody says, well, what if we did this for you or did that for you? And it's like, oh, that'll give me some breathing room. And like you say, then 3 days later, they get the job or something gets better or there's some help, ongoing help with vet bills or whatever it might be.
Exactly.
Yeah. So.
And it's a great, that's a great public-private partnership, too. So it's not that the shelter itself has to come up with all these resources. That's when you partner with other groups in your town. Maybe there is a group that is already running a food bank, or maybe there's a low-cost vet clinic that has an angel fund to help people in need. So again, it's not that you as the shelter have to come up with everything for everyone, but you start building your resources. And, you know, if someone says, this is my problem, and you're like, gee, I don't know if I have any resources, you just kind of put it out there and figure out, what does this person need and how can I get it for them? And it's really great. The community wants to help. There are so many times when groups are working in silos in their own city or town, and they don't even know that someone else is already offering this resource up. So
yeah,
it's a great opportunity to work together and to collaborate. And, you know, you're sharing the burden of gathering these resources, but also sharing what's already out there.
Well, again, this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and I'm speaking with Cameron Moore, Program Manager of the Million Cat Challenge, which we're discussing in a conversation that was recorded Monday. Cameron will be speaking at KittyCon Tampa 2019, taking place November 30th and December 1st at the DoubleTree by Hilton Tampa Airport West Shore. So let me ask you this, Cameron, because those have been around the shelter world for any length of time, whether as direct participants like you or more as observers like me, know that statistics sometime in this realm can be fluid, shall we say, about intake, about release, about euthanasia. So what are the criteria that's used here to constitute a cat's life being saved, and especially because it sounds like the distinction here is the number that are being saved beyond what would ordinarily have happened?
Okay, so we're very data-driven,
mm-hmm.
and so we do actually, we look at everyone's numbers, and we ask our participating shelters to share their numbers with us every year so that we can kind of look at trends. And what we find truly is when you implement these life-saving strategies, we see intake productively going down.
Mm-hmm.
And then as a result, euthanasia also goes down and your life-saving increases.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a phenomenon, but we see it everywhere. So we know it's not just, oh, that was a fluke and you guys were really lucky. And when shelters are having, you know, maybe some challenges, we would work with them directly and kind of really dig into what seems to be the problem. And a lot of times it's funny because it's self-imposed barriers that are creating the problems in the shelters. It's not the programs. It's that, well, we have this program, but we're going to limit it to certain days or certain cats or certain age ranges or certain, you know, and it's just like, and they do it out of fear. You know, it's everybody's afraid of the unknown or afraid to take that first step. So again, our role is to guide these shelter leaders and shelter staff through the process so that they can be brave and do it. And then they see the life saving and then they become the champions for it.
So I think you touched on one, maybe two of the key initiatives. Can you maybe just briefly at least outline the others that are pivotal to this campaign?
Sure. So we talked about managed admissions, but there's also alternatives to intake because, again, bringing an animal into the shelter is not always the best choice for that animal. We also talk about capacity for care because, again, you can be super proud that you never turn anyone away and you accept, you know, all any time of the day, but how many animals can your staff actually care for in a day? How much housing do you have for them? Is it appropriate housing? And are you burdening your staff? And then it's the animals who suffer from it. And again, it's not that anyone intentionally says like, gee, I want to set myself up for failure here. But because we have such good hearts, sometimes that's exactly what we do. So capacity for care is very important, and that's both staff and animals. And then also, you know, removing barriers to adoption, that's really huge because, again, when you work in shelters, sometimes your microcosm is this horrible place where animals are the victims of cruelty and neglect. And so when a nice family walks in to adopt, we kind of treat them like criminals, because we don't want them to turn into those bad people who are the ones who have maybe neglected or abused an animal. And so it's funny, like, because we are subjected to negativity in our little corner of the world here, we then kind of think that everyone is that bad person, and we forget that most people in our world are good.
Yeah.
And so we have to sometimes remind people, like, hey, these are nice, you know, soccer moms and professional people, and it doesn't matter if you're young or old, like, you can still be a good person, so quit treating them like they're criminals.
Yeah, I mean, and I guess those initiatives kind of bring me to a question, is how do shelters join? I mean, is this somewhat a self-selecting contingent? In other words, a shelter inclined to participate in the Million Cat Challenge might already kind of inherently reflect the campaign's fundamental values and maybe unofficially kind of adhering to at least some of the five initiatives to begin with, or how to...
Right. The challenge is open for anyone who works in or for any shelter that's brick and mortar. Mm-hmm. We do also have a subset for rescue only who are like foster-based, but again, mm-hmm. we're primarily focusing on brick and mortar shelters because that's where the euthanasia tends to happen.
Sure.
And so we want all shelters all across North America to join. And when you join, which is a very easy process, you can just go to milliontcatchallenge.org. It'll ask you for some just information, like, what do you already, you know, do you already participate in these initiatives? And some might be already doing all five, but they're still limiting themselves because they don't know what they don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Or some may have an interest in particular areas. So it's just a wide variety. And of course, our team makes contact with everybody who joins, and we're here to help, and we're a support group. And so it's definitely beneficial for all.
Sure. And I guess the idea is, whether they maybe didn't know it at first, if they were already doing, let's say, one or maybe even two of the initiatives, they're probably well on the right track and just probably need some further resources or support, or just to be, again, part of that overall group, and people can air their particular challenges and say, well, this is what happened when in our city they said this, and this is how we responded, and it actually worked out. And just like anything else that's kind of based on a group support.
Yes, and so we often have webinars. We are at all of the major conferences with our booths. We send out emails and blogs, and so we're in constant touch. And of course, we encourage our challengers to reach out to us if they have questions, and if it's not something we can help with. Of course, we always put them in touch with other challengers who could maybe help them on a peer-to-peer level.
And so how do those statistics get accumulated and then reported? I mean, if I'm not mistaken, I think the numbers for an individual shelter, at least within the Million Cat Challenge, aren't necessarily reported. It's more the combined results by those that are.
Well, we have a really great data team, and mm-hmm. so we do ask our challengers to provide their annual data. So once a year, we ask them to submit that, and if they're already part of Shelter Animals Count, which is another nonprofit movement trying to collect data in shelters around the country, if they're a part of that already and they opt into our coalition, then we can just automatically grab their data, which saves them from having to provide the same information to multiple groups. So we're really encouraging people to do that. And then our team analyzes everything. And it really is phenomenal to see the transformation that shelters are having when they implement these strategies. I mean, they're able to help more, save more, not have to euthanize as many. There are always going to be euthanasia, especially of, you know, medical cases that are beyond hope. And then in the cases of dogs with dangerous dogs. So we're not trying to say that there's never going to be euthanasia, but at the same time, you see drastic decreases in it, because for the most part, in the past, shelters have euthanized especially a high amount of cats just for population control. That's no other reason than that.
Well, this may dovetail with what we're talking about, but the reason we're not doing this interview live is that you had a previous commitment at the time that we would have done it live to do a shelter consult. So what does that mean and what does that involve?
Sure. So that is actually my main part of my job, and I travel around the country working very closely with shelters who would like to make sure that they're implementing all the strategies they can to work more efficiently, but also to solve the problems in their community, to productively decrease their intake and increase their life savings. So just about every other week, I'm at a different shelter, and we look at everything, not just what's happening in the shelter itself, but what's happening in the community, what resources are available, but we analyze who's coming into the shelter, why, what are their programs in place, what's happening once they're there. You know, how can we remove barriers to life-saving? So it's a pretty intensive assessment, and I think by the end of the week, everybody's super happy, but at the same time, it's like, can be a little stressful. Only, you know, if someone comes into your house and peeks in all your closets, you get a little nervous. But it's all in a positive way, just to support the shelter and the staff, and there's never been a time that we came in and we're not able to provide really good or to find opportunities for them and to provide good recommendations. Because even if you're doing fabulous, there's usually something that you don't realize you could be doing more efficiently or better or different. Because again, when you're in it, it's hard to see, you know, that there's another way, because you're just so busy doing
swamped.
What you do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So is the shelter consult sometimes an interim step on the path for a shelter to join the Million Cat Challenge, or do some shelters do it afterwards just to further refine their operation?
Right. So it is definitely not a requirement to join the Million Cat Challenge, and we encourage everybody to join, but there are certain shelters that we try to really help, and it's dependent on, honestly, we look at their intake and euthanasia numbers, and so we can identify who really needs some help. And I think everybody could benefit from an assessment, but our team is so small that we're not able to provide it to everyone.
Sure.
But we do have opportunities throughout the year where people can apply for an assessment, and in fact, we're going through that right now, and we've just had some really great applications come in, and we're reviewing those and are going to try to figure out who we're going to be able to help in the next, 6 months of 2020.
Well, so we're in our final few moments here of our conversation, Cameron, and again, I'm speaking with Cameron Moore, Program Manager of Million Cat Challenge, and she will be speaking at KittyCon Tampa 2019, which is happening on November 30th and December 1st at the DoubleTree by Hilton Tampa Airport West Shore. In fact, with that in mind, can you give us a little bit of a sneak preview of the talk that you'll be delivering at KittyCon?
Well, actually, I'm giving two talks there.
Oh, okay.
I'm super excited.
Oh, great.
One
I only
of them
saw
is
one,
gonna
I guess.
Be
yeah.
about the Million Cat Challenge and how it evolved and what we're doing to help cats in shelters around the country. But the other one is going to be talking to people about understanding community cats and why. So we've trained the public that if you see a cat outside, it must be lost, and so you must pick it up and take it to a shelter. And we need to retrain the public that that's not the case.
Yeah.
Not every cat that you see outside is lost or in need of help. So that's going to be one of the big factors, especially because we know that so many people do allow their pet cats to go in and out, or to be outdoor cats. And it's not just feral cats that live outside. It's friendly, happy, healthy cats that go outside. And we need to train people to stop stealing people's pets.
Right.
So that's actually another one of my topics.
Oh, great. And I noticed that it's hard to keep up with the term. I mean, for a while, they were called feral cats. Then it seems like community cats, which I guess is still the term. But I think I saw something recently where it was like unowned cats, with like a subdivision, I guess, of what we once knew as feral cats. And I guess I think there's some other term that I saw recently that I thought, well, it's hard to keep up with the terms. But
Sure. There's a lot of words for everything. We pretty much try to just call them community cats.
Okay.
Community cats can be owned or unowned. They could be feral or friendly. Mm-hmm. But again, if I'm a person who lets my cat in and out, say my cat says, you can't keep me in, I want to go outside, and my cat goes outside and you're walking down the street, typically what happens, what we've heard, is people are like, oh my gosh, there's a friendly cat there, I must save its life and rush it to the nearest shelter. And you're going to tell the shelter, this is a stray cat, it was lost, I found it on the sidewalk.
Yeah.
Well, it's actually an owned cat, you just don't know who the owner is, and you've made assumptions. So we truly feel like there really aren't any stray cats. The cats know exactly who cares for them, whether they're sleeping inside at night or whether they live on someone's porch because that's their choice. These cats are doing well. They really just need us for sterilization and vaccination, and then we just need to leave them alone. So we need to quit projecting our own stories onto them. And I've had new neighbors move onto my street who have unintentionally stolen my porch cats because cats are cats, and they're opportunists, and they will come to your door and ask for a handout.
Sure.
And then the person will say, oh my gosh, she was starving, and she was so friendly, she must be lost.
Yeah.
No, she's a beggar, and she's
right.
fat,
and
that's
she
why
tricked
she's
you.
Down.
Yeah, right.
Right. But again, people do it with the best of intentions.
Of course.
They don't need to steal someone's cat, but they don't know.
Right, no,
so
that's the
to
thing.
Tell people, if they're healthy, if they look good, if they are 12 pounds, leave them alone, you know?
Yeah, no, that's, again, as you suggested, so well-intentioned, but sometimes it's like, just let them be and don't be so well-intentioned that you're actually causing
right.
a problem here. But
right.
So, Cameron, so how has doing this sort of work over the years affected your feelings for cats? I mean, different in any discernible way?
Boy, so in addition to what I do for work, I also started a nonprofit cat rescue about 15 years ago. So my life has definitely evolved into all cats all the time.
Wow, okay.
But I'm just so grateful that I have the opportunity to share this information, which we're always learning, right?
Yeah.
It's constantly evolving. The way we did business 5-10 years ago is not the way we're doing business now when it comes to cats. So I just think it's a great opportunity for us to always keep our minds open how we can help cats. And sometimes that does mean going into a shelter, and sometimes that doesn't. So I just think, you know, having the ability to like to share this with you and your listeners is fantastic, and being able to go to KittyCon and meet like regular everyday people who love cats and who aren't necessarily in the business. I just think we all need to keep sharing and definitely, cats have taken over my life.
Yeah.
In a good way.
Well, that reminds me, two quick things. One, in the way of full disclosure, I should say that I'm serving as a MC of KittyCon all weekend, so I'll be conducting some interviews, moderating a panel, etc. But also, tell me in our last moment here, including porch cats and others that you've alluded to, tell me about the current cat population at your house. What are we looking at there? Would you rather not say?
Well, we don't talk in numbers around here.
Yeah, okay. All right.
But I'll just tell you, everyone's fat and happy. I do actually have 6 dogs. It's funny, people are like, wait a minute, you're a dog person too? I thought you were just a cat lady. But I actually have, I have indoor cats, I have outdoor cats, I have porch cats, and they're all a different population. But they all get the same, you know, gold standard treatment.
Yeah.
It's just whatever they've determined they want.
Sure.
So, and that's one thing that I've learned too is growing up, I always thought every cat should be inside. And if you had your cats outside, you were a bad person and you're a bad pet owner. And what I've realized is that's not really the case. And while it's safer and best for cats to stay inside, sometimes that's not what they choose. And it really should be about, doing the best for every cat for whatever their situation is.
Let that cat be that cat.
That's right.
Okay. Well, thank you, Cameron. We're speaking with Cameron Moore, again, Program Manager of Million Cat Challenge. There's all kinds of great information about the things we were discussing and things we didn't get a chance to discuss at milliancatchallenge.org. And one more time, Cameron will be giving not one, but two talks at KittyCon Tampa. That's, again, coming up November 30th and December 1st at the DoubleTree by Hilton Tampa Airport West Shore. I look forward to seeing you there and listening to your talks. Cameron, thanks so much for joining us today on Talking Animals.
Thanks so much, Duncan.
Bye-bye. Okay, my thanks again to Cameron Moore for making the time to join us on Talking Animals amidst an obviously very busy schedule. In a moment, I'll speak with Michelle LaFleur about Thanks Vegan, the 13th annual edition of Thanks Vegan in Tampa, that is. Meanwhile, in the Comedy Corner, I'll be playing a piece I intended to play last week, but somehow ended up airing something I'd played on the previous show. So this is Nate Bargatze with a piece called How to Get Bitten by a Snake in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
I went to Honduras, another place. Because I was at the airport, and the guy was like, I'm going to Honduras. He was like, what city? And I was like, I'm just learning right now that's not the name of the city. So just wherever other people are going, probably. Let's just go there and figure it out. We get to the base, and the guy, he's like telling us about Honduras, and he's like, you gotta be careful. He's like, you gotta really look out for snakes. There's a lot of venomous snakes here. So when you walk around, just keep an eye out. And he was like, now if you get bit by a snake, the best thing to do is then just go ahead and catch the snake and bring it, so then we know like what snake bit you. I was like, dude, I'm pretty positive that's like exactly what you're not supposed to. Like, I've never seen that ever on Animal Planet. Like, someone gets bit and then they gotta be like, now I gotta get it. I was like, I'm not gonna do it. I was like, that doesn't make sense. I've never caught a snake in my life. And then when I got bit for the first time, I got to get it together and catch a snake. I was like, it's not going to go good, man. I was like, he's going to keep biting me. That's all that's going to happen. And he was like, it doesn't matter. Like, you've already been bit. And I was like, do you even know what a snake is? It completely matters. There's a huge difference between one bite and probably 30 bites. That's what we're going to be at if I try to catch this snake. Who told you this? The snake? Is that who told you to tell me all of this? Whose side are you on?
That was Nate Bargatze with a piece called How to Get Bitten by a Snake, taken from one of his TV appearances. Now let's speak with Michelle LaFleur about Thanks Vegan. This is Michelle LaFleur on Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Michelle.
Good morning, Duncan.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so there's a great history to this event. I mean, I remember when Thanks Vegan, I should say, was first launched many moons ago, and I think there was a hiatus year or two, but otherwise it's been like just a steadily rolling and super popular event.
You know, it's heartwarming to know that you remember that, and this is our 13th annual.
Yeah, I guess almost goes without saying that if not every year incrementally over time, it's really become popular and it's a big sought after thing for people to as an option of how to spend their Thanksgiving Day. So
yeah, it's incredible. You know, the first couple years and even sometimes now, people would walk in with tears in their eyes with just so much gratitude that there was, you know, a place to go without having to be picked on or ridiculed for not eating the bird on the table.
Getting just a little bit of a gauge of the popularity, how many folks would you say attended last year's Thanks Vegan?
It's close to over 300.
And you expect a similar number this year or
we
more?
Do, yep. And we have beautiful weather coming, and we have some outside grounds and beautiful trees and tents for the outdoor and tables inside as well.
Cool.
There's plenty of room for everybody.
Yeah, so that's great. So walk us through a little bit about some of the key details, starting with, like, I touched on this at the beginning of the show, but still, let's talk about where this happens and when specifically, like time of day, and in addition, obviously, to Thanksgiving Day itself. And just kind of run us through some of the key details for people who may not be familiar with it and may say, hey, I'm kind of still forming my plans for Thanksgiving, and maybe this is the thing for me.
Yeah, well, let me start by saying that anyone that won't hear me say it later, I'll just say it now.
A lot of information can be found on thanksvegan.com, so keep that in mind.
Okay, great website.
Great
okay.
Times are wonderful. People that have donated, you can RSVP, you can pay in advance, get ideas of food to bring.
Okay, so but meanwhile, for people who aren't on the website at the moment, maybe you could say where it's happening and what the times of day are and some other details about
yes,
the event.
Yes, we host it at the Unitarian Universalist Church. We rent their hall, and it is from 2 p.m. to 5:30 p.m. So you can bring a dish or you can not bring a dish. There's two options, two payment options. And the social begins at 1:30 to 2. The potluck dinner is from 2 to 5:30. And then there's also silent auction and raffles.
And Michelle, once the food starts, are people like eating in shifts? I mean, again, if you're thinking about 300 people, like how does that, I mean, just in terms of crowd management, how does that work?
No, that's a super, super great question because, you know, a lot of people don't know how it works. So when you come, you're going to get a number on your name tag. And we start the food line. We do it in numbers of 50 or groups of 50. So 1 through 50 will go and then 50 through 100. And it goes super quick. So if your name tag has 255 on it, don't worry. We keep food back. So there's constantly refreshed new food. And it goes by order of your name tag of when you showed up.
So that's the thing. So people who might arrive there and think, oh, my goodness, they'll never have enough food for me. That you guys, again, you've been doing this quite a few years. You know exactly how to do it. And it's not like somebody's going to, if they come a bit later or whatever, say, oh, my goodness, I'm out of luck.
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked that because you do see the panic on people's faces. We're like, oh my gosh, I'm number 250. There'll be no food left because they could put the food on the table.
Yeah.
We always do plenty. I mean, so much back. So everyone has some and seconds as well.
Yeah, cool. So obviously there's so many dishes there, and this is probably sort of like the favorite child kind of question. But can you name, like, I don't know, a few dishes that over the years maybe people have been coming each year that people either are surprised by but delighted by or just things that are kind of really faves that have emerged over the years?
Well, you know, we always have the staples for Thanksgiving. We'll always have the roast, the tofurkeys, the stuffings, and mashed potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
So those will be provided by our wonderful people that have donated. And one that always stood out, one of our guests always liked to bring a soup and a pumpkin. That was so always so beautiful, and everyone would see that.
That's great.
So you can be creative or not.
Yeah.
You know, as long as it's vegan and there's no animal products, it'll be super welcome.
Right. And again, that information is going to be at thanksvegan.com. But basically, again, there's just sort of like a little formula. Like if you're bringing a dish, then your reservation would have one price. If you're not bringing a dish, and then again, if you're coming as a couple or a family, then things expand accordingly in terms of...
When you go to thanksvegan.com, you'll see the different prices for if you're bringing a dish or not.
Yeah.
And the way to prepay. Yep.
And then I guess if I remember correctly, by around 5:30 or so, other than whatever cleanup there may still be, that's people have had their great meal and they're off and running for whatever else, a movie or whatever else they might want to do that
right.
day.
That's right. There's two things I want to not forget.
Okay.
Carpooling is encouraged.
Okay.
Parking is tight.
Yeah.
And we don't allow people to bring their own plates to eat off of. We provide those.
And also, wise guy, don't show up with a big Tupperware to-go container, man. It doesn't work that way either.
I've seen it. No, it's happened.
No, I'm sure.
This is why I had to say it.
Yeah, no, it's so funny.
And, okay. If people can, please write down your ingredients prior to showing up so you can get through the line quicker.
Yeah, no, that's super helpful because, again, people want to know what's in your particular dish, and it's just great. If ideally, obviously, if you could write it out neatly or type them up, that just makes everything smooth and easy for everybody who are already really busy that day, obviously. So, well, this sounds great once again, Michelle. So, again, it's thanksvegan.com for all the info, the details about bringing the dish, about how to pay, about how to, I think there's two different, I don't know what the cutoff point is for advance reservations, but I think another element is if you make reservations enough ahead, that's even yet another factor for a cost or whatever. So the main thing is to go to that website or there's also a Facebook event page. Easily search for that.
Page. Yeah. And I encourage people just to check out the site because it'll help you understand when you're there and kind of minimize the confusion.
That's great. Just give you the lowdown if you've never been before. So, Michelle, thank you so much for joining us on Talking Animals and wishing you a happy Thanksgiving and another great event on that day.
Thank you, Duncan, and happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
All right. Thanks so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Coming up at 11 on WMNF, it's Rob Loray with Radioactivity, extending this three-hour block of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, including in the noon hour midpoint with Nola Lalay. Then at 1 p.m., the music kicks back in with Euro Radio, hosted by Paco Morales, flowing into Scott Elliott and the All Souls edition of It's the Music at 2 p.m. and continuing into the evening, the wee hours, and beyond. Meanwhile, on today's show, as the prize for Name That Animal Tune, I'll be offering a set of spectacular animal-oriented greeting cards designed by artist extraordinaire Jared Edson. So we are moving into Name That Animal Tune. This is a contest. There'll be a prize, that set of the greeting cards, really cool-looking greeting cards. The first person who calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal song, but this quick note on the song itself. This is tied to Uke It Out, the latest of Flea's fabulous ukulele festivals. This one's happening December 7th at Cage Brewing. And one element of that six-hour extravaganza is the Bob Marley of the ukulele contest. So go to WMNF.org for more information, to get your tickets, etc. And along those lines, I thought let's hear this. It's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals on WMNF. If you can name that animal to him, we might take your guess off the air. Maybe we'll even take it on the air. Who knows? Looks like the lines are full. You know what? Let's go a little bit nuts here like we used to in the old days. Hi, you're live on the air on Talking Animals on WMNF. Can you name that animal tune?
I can. Three little birds.
I'm sorry?
Three little birds.
That's exactly right. Ukulele style, no less.
Yes, it's wonderful.
Cool. What's your name?
Linda Valier.
Okay, Linda, I'm going to come back and get your information and send you off these greeting cards, which I think you're going to love. So hang tight. I'll be back.
I will.
Okay. All right, we have a winner, obviously, and we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Again, I'll be gone next Wednesday, but Bev Capshaw will be here in my absence, so I want to wish you and yours a happy Thanksgiving and a happy Thanksvegan. And maybe I'll see some of you at KittyCon Tampa 2019 on the Saturday and Sunday of Thanksgiving weekend. Otherwise, I'll speak with you again right here on Talking Animals on WMNF on December 4th. I invite you to visit talkinganimals.net for audio archives of every show we've ever broadcast. iTunes podcasts are available there, too. There are also links to our Facebook page, our Instagram page, our Twitter feed, and more. Please like us on Facebook, the show, and or me personally, and follow me on Twitter and Instagram. You can also subscribe to our newsletter to find out about our guests a couple of days beforehand and other scintillating news from the Talking Animals headquarters. That's all found at talkinganimals.net. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. This is Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weeki Wachee, and beyond. NPR News headlines, and then Rob. Thanks.